Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello and welcome to Desert Island Dishes with me, Margie. I hope you've had a great week and overindulged suitably. Hopefully this episode can bridge the gap if you're in need of a bit of alone time away from the family and you can sneak off or just put your headphones in your ears there and then. If you do have a spare moment, do subscribe, leave a 5-star rating and review as it really does give the show a little boost and helps me to keep bringing it to you each week. This is an exciting episode with one of the most famous chefs and restaurateurs in London. We find out about the dishes that have shaped Mark's life, his business highs, and even some lows. We discover he has an unusual love of ceramic jugs, all things offal, and we find out which restaurant in the world he likes so much he wishes it were his. Without further ado, here is today's episode. My guest today is Mark Hicks. Renowned chef and restaurateur, Mark is widely recognized as the reviver of modern British cuisine and is famous for his focus on a straightforward interpretation of British cooking. He is without a doubt one of London's most eminent restaurateurs. Mark launched his first restaurant, Hicks Oyster and Chop House in Farringdon in 2008, after having spent 17 years as chef director at Caprice Holdings. He followed the opening of his first restaurant with Hicks at Brown's Hotel, Hicks Soho, and the chicken and steak restaurants Tramshed in Shoreditch and Hicks to Bankside. In February 2016, Mark teamed up with the artist Damien Hirst to open Pharmacy 2 at the Newport Street Gallery in Vauxhall. Somehow, amongst all of that, Mark has written 10 cookbooks, he has a weekly food column, and he hosts an annual food festival in Lyme Regis, Food Rocks, to showcase the best producers and suppliers in Dorset and nearby. It has been said about Mark by none other than Tracy Emin, what's amazing about his success is how nice he is. People have said that it's hard to describe you as just a chef because you're much more of a businessman slash food artist. Isn't that quite a cool description?
Well, the thing is, when you have restaurants, you have to do a bit of everything, really.
Yeah.
So, I design the restaurants myself, you know, go to junkyards and collect stuff.
That's so cool.
Lights, that sort of stuff.
And that surely, it's not something that you have to do, like you could get someone else to do that, but it's sort of part of the overall...
I just feel that it gives it your own touch, really. Definitely. If you get involved in the sort of design element.
Definitely.
So I sort of love doing that, and I do that at home as well. So I, redesign my apartment and from scratch. So, so a bit of everything, really. I collect a bit of art, and that's often part, a big part of the design of the restaurant.
I like the phrase food artist. I think that's something to aspire to. So you've worked in some capacity since the age of 12, and you say yourself that you had no grand ambitions as a child and fell into cooking. Is it true you wondered whether to study catering or metalwork?
No. So what happened was, in the fifth year at school, it was the first time boys could opt out of a subject and do domestic science.
Oh, right.
So it's a choice of metalwork or domestic science.
Okay.
So I used to hate metalwork. So three of us decided to do domestic science, thinking we'd be in a classroom full of girls.
Yeah.
And then all the girls decided to do metalwork.
Oh, no way.
So we turned up and there's three boys and the teacher.
That's hilarious. What are the chances?
I know. So, but anyway, so we just messed around for a year, and it wasn't, and I worked in a pub, in the weekends and stuff. I kind of just, yeah, that was sort of falling into it, really.
Yeah.
And still didn't know what to do when I...
And it was at Weymouth College that you met Laurie Mills, the teacher, and your first significant culinary inspiration.
Yeah, so he was very inspiring. You know, he'd worked in London and was always talking about London. He was a good laugh. Outside of work, we used to sort of go and party at his place.
So he sort of inspired you to cook, but also sort of dreaming of London.
The fun element as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, which then was, you know, quite attractive for me, that it wasn't just slogging away all day. You know, there was some fun.
Definitely.
Attached.
So you grew up in Bridport, a seaside town on the Dorset coast, and you were raised by your grandparents on a diet of simple country dishes. So I'm looking forward to hearing your first desert island dish of the day. And that's the dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
Yeah, so it was probably, well, one of two things, or you could serve them together. So I used to go fishing for mackerel when I was a kid, and I used to bring a carrier bag home, and my gran would, you know, cook it up that night for supper and then souse the rest and put them in the fridge.
Yum.
And then my grandfather used to grow tomatoes in his greenhouse. So the sort of souse mackerel and the fresh tomatoes just sprinkled with salt and Sarsen's vinegar were my sort of childhood memories, but simple things.
Yeah, simple but delicious.
So that probably later in life sort of influenced my sort of simple approach to cooking.
Really. Yeah. Also, that implies you were quite a good fisherman.
Well, it was just mackerel. They're easy. Really.
Are they easy? Yeah. On moving to London, you worked at some of the best hotels around, the Hilton, the Grosvenor House Hotel and the Dorchester. What were those years like? Was it play hard, work hard?
Yeah, it was a bit play hard, work hard. It, you know, it's quite a tough business to be in. And, you know, when you're a young kid, you want to sort of learn as much as possible and sort of, you know, fresh in London.
Yeah.
You know, that was...
Did you love working in a professional kitchen from the get-go? Like, was it just
Yeah, it's a very good... You get a very good sense of discipline. It's a good sort of social thing.
Yeah.
And
seriously hard work.
Yeah, it's hard work. But I was sort of lucky, I think, that I didn't work in kitchens where you had to work from sort of 7 a.m. till midnight.
Okay.
So the Grosvenor House and the Dorchester were sort of shifts. You know, a lot of friends of mine later in life were working sort of all day and night, really.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a lucky escape.
Yeah, I was.
At the age of just 22, you got your first job as head chef. And of that time, you say, it was a bit about being in the right place at the right time. I asked if I could have his job and that was it, really. But was it really that simple?
Yeah, no, it was. I suppose I fast-tracked my career a little bit.
Yeah.
From, you know, working in hotels to working in a small sort of unknown restaurant and then sort of working my way up, really, from there. So that little stint after the hotels for 4 years put me in good stead to then go on to do, you know, the Caprice and the Ivy and Cheeky's and stuff.
Yeah. Do you think with all successful people, there is an element of luck and happenstance involved? Is that just the nature?
Yeah, I think so. You know, I think there is an element of luck, you know, who you bump into or whatever.
Yeah.
And I think being in the right place at the right time. It's certainly.
But then I guess it's also the flip side is you're putting yourself out there and making sure you're kind of in the right place at the right time. So it's sort of, I don't know, it's a combination.
Yeah. Yeah. You fall into it. I suppose it's, you know, who you hang out with or whatever. It's,
yeah. Moving on to the second desert island dish of the day. What's the first dish you learned to cook?
The first dish I learned to cook. It might have been that soused mackerel with my grandmother.
Yeah.
She used to make sort of cakes and things, but I didn't really regard that as cooking. I didn't really cook with her much. I was just curious sometimes.
Yeah. Like, how old were you when you actually...
Well, probably in that domestic science thing at school.
What were the kind of things
we used to do things like pineapple upside down cake and that sort of stuff, which much later in life I ended up putting back on the menu.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's such a delicious sort of dish.
It really is. So delicious.
Sticky sort of, yeah.
Yeah. So it came full circle.
Mm.
Yeah. So your first venue, Hicks Oyster and Chop House in London, Smithfield. What are the practical realities of opening a restaurant? How did you go from deciding that you did actually want your own place to making that happen?
Well, at the time, my business partner and I, we sort of...
How did you find your business partner?
Well, we worked together at the Caprice Group.
Okay.
Yeah. And he left before me. Whilst I was still there, sort of, you know, saying, you know, should we do something together? And then suddenly this restaurant came up in Smithfield, which was good size. It was affordable.
Was it already a restaurant?
Yeah, it was. It'd been there since the 70s. I'd actually been there before. It was called Rudland and Stubbs.
Okay.
It was an old fish restaurant. Yeah, we did a sort of simple refurb, you know, we didn't have any money.
Yep.
And
so you had investors?
No investors, no. There was just two of us.
Okay. That's amazing.
So I was always the majority shareholder. And yeah, so we did it up and, you know, sort of found some old lights and we sort of kept the old tiles on the walls and the marble bar top and that sort of thing.
And is it true that even now, sort of with every restaurant that you open, you find the location and then you kind of build the concept around?
Yeah,
was that true even back then?
So because it was an old part of London in the old Smithfield Market, I just finished writing the British Regional book. And in London, then sort of old restaurants were either chop houses or taverns.
Okay.
And Oysters had sort of faded out of London. A couple of friends of mine, the Wright brothers and Richard Corrigan, had opened oyster bars. I thought, you know, the sort of meat scare had just gone on.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, you know, time to get meat on the bone back on.
Yeah.
So the combination of what was street food in London, oysters, and serving all the meat on the bone, you know, it was quite risky. But I needed to do something new that people weren't quite expecting.
Yeah. So it felt like a bit of a risk, but a risk that paid off. And did you find the different, like, did you find the experience of being a head chef to actually being head chef and owner? Was that whole thing really different to?
Yeah. Well, it is a bit, yeah. And from day one, when I opened the chop house, I kind of employed a head chef so that I could keep an eye on everything.
Okay.
Even though we were only one restaurant in, but soon to open Hicks Oyster and Fish House.
Okay. So you sort of always had your eye on the
yeah, bigger. And that came up more or less the same time as we were opening. So we got that open sort of 3 months later.
That's so cool. So but everything just happened quite quickly.
Yeah, so it's quite a nice story, you know, to have Hicks Oyster and Chop House in London, Hicks Oyster and Fish House, town in Dorset.
Yeah, so really
near,
nice.
Near hometown.
Yeah. Okay, Mark, moving on to the third Desert Island dish of the day. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
Best dish I've ever eaten? I've eaten lots of good dishes. It's quite difficult to sort of...
It's a head scratcher.
Yeah, there it is. You know, there's dishes that I've eaten which have just been simply cooked. Cod tongues, for example, in Spain, when I first ever tasted them, which are on the menu now. And then I had a dish in Spain. I used to have a girlfriend whose parents live in Spain. So a lot of my influences in the early days came from Spain when I first started at Caprice, from things like black rice. I had a dish called tripa de bacalao, which is cod tripe.
Ooh.
Which was the kind of salted belly and some of the innards. Which is really tasty. It's with wild mushrooms.
So is that probably, quite traditional Spanish?
Well, it is in some regions.
Okay.
Yeah. It's very much a sort of Catalan thing. And some of the restaurants around there at the time were just very, very simple. So I think probably a mixture of dishes from that sort of period. Nothing in particular, but I sort of always make reference to those very simple sort of Catalan dishes.
Yeah. Does that mean that if you ever play the game where... you're only allowed to eat one type of cuisine for the rest of your life, would it be Spanish?
Spanish or Italian, maybe.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, good choices.
One other dish that stood out was actually in Italy. It was a braised horse cheek.
Ooh.
It was really simple with apple sauce. That was quite interesting. I'd never eaten horse cheek.
No, before. I don't think I have either. Have you eaten them since?
No, because, you know, you can't get it in this country.
Yeah.
But I would go back to that restaurant for that dish.
Mm, okay. So you were chef director at Caprice, which is very smart and formal dining. And your own places, by contrast, have all been slightly less formal and they sort of feel a lot more fun. Was that a conscious decision?
Well, Caprice wasn't that formal, really. It was, you know, the food was very simple. It was a brasserie environment.
Yeah.
So I suppose I took a lot of my... It was a bit like a sort of New York brasserie, I suppose, if you like.
Yeah.
Best way to describe it. And then working for Chris Corbin and Jeremy King, you know, they were sort of big influences on what I'm doing now, I suppose.
Yeah.
And cooking for the customer as opposed to cooking, you know, what the chef wants to eat.
Yeah. different kind of cooking.
Yeah. So that was a big sort of learning curve in my life, in my career, really. Working for Chris and Jeremy. Yeah.
So you've managed and owned some of the top restaurants in London. And this is obviously a difficult question, but what is the secret to a great restaurant? So you seem to sort of have the magic formula.
Well, not always. There are so many restaurants opening now that, you know, you have to sort of constantly be, you know, trying to keep on top of your game because new restaurants open, new trends occur. What was, you know, what was someone's favorite restaurant last year is not necessarily always their favorite restaurant this year.
Yeah. So do you feel that you feel sort of a constant pressure to sort of innovate and with all the competition?
Sometimes it's the magic formula, sometimes.
But saying that, you haven't opened any that haven't worked? Like,
well, no, I have. That's the thing. So, I opened a restaurant in Belgravia in a hotel about 6 years ago. The hotel was being run, it was a new hotel run by Thompson Hotels.
Okay.
60 Thompson in New York.
Yeah.
And I knew them and I thought, okay, we haven't got a restaurant in the area. Opened and then...
What was the name of the hotel?
It was Belgrave's Hotel. Okay. And Hicks Belgravia was the restaurant.
Yeah.
Anyway, it sort of started off okay. It wasn't that busy because I later found that Belgravia was full of, you know, big expensive houses, but not many people actually lived in them.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And then after about 6 or 7 months, I thought, yeah, this is not going very well. We're not making any money. We're losing money. So I managed to pull out because we never, ever got to sign our 10-year contract.
Oh, right.
So I got out after 11 months and lost like £800,000.
Okay.
So that was a bit of a learning curve.
Yeah.
And that wasn't one of my successes, but it was, yeah, certainly a learning point.
But you bounced back. And I think probably that's very encouraging for other people to hear that, you know, that that's bound to happen in any successful person's life.
Yeah. And there's one other restaurant, which was in the city in Devonshire Square, which didn't quite work out. We sort of hung on for 2 years. It just didn't work. So what I've learned now is if you open something and it doesn't work, just get the hell out.
I wonder with restaurants, like how long is that period that you give it? Like if it's...
Well, you know, this one was, the Belgravia one was quite short, you know, 11 months.
Because do you think if you'd persevered, things could have changed?
I don't know. I drive past it on my scooter now sometimes and it looks a bit dead.
Yeah, okay. So you're like, that was still a good decision.
It's changed about 3 times.
Since. Okay, that's always a sign, isn't it? Right, moving on to possibly the most important question of the day. It's the fourth desert island dish. What is your favourite sandwich?
My favourite sandwich? Well, I sort of, you know, I quite like a good old-fashioned cheese and pickle sandwich.
Nothing wrong with that, Mark.
I love a good club sandwich.
Yes.
But over the years, we've sort of invented different sandwiches. We do a shrimp burger, which is served at the Fish House. I saw it in an American magazine about 15 years ago. It's basically just minced up prawns with spring onions and a bit of spice. And you make that into a sort of burger.
Yum.
With a spicy tartar sauce. So that's probably one of my favourite sandwiches, I would say.
Yeah.
But, you know, at different times of the day, you know,
good
bacon butty in the morning.
Yes.
Good bacon, sourdough, brown sauce, preferably.
Yep, nothing wrong
always works.
With that.
So, yeah, different sandwiches for different times of the day, I think, really.
Yeah, no, I think that's a fair answer. Depends how you're feeling.
Yeah, and I suppose there's different classifications of sandwich. I did a dinner party on Saturday night and I did a take on the Chinese prawn toasts.
Ooh.
But I did it with cuttlefish and cuttlefish ink.
Ooh.
So I sort of blended it up.
That sounds amazing.
And spread it on these sort of round toasts and dipped them in black and white sesame. So that was a good
yum
sort of sandwich.
Yeah,
really.
Yeah. That counts.
And I think, you know, that you can go quite a long way with sandwiches. I've not answered your question. What's my favourite all-time sandwich?
You're skirting around
it. I think there are different sandwiches for different occasions.
If I put a gun to your head and you had to pick a sandwich, which one of those would you pick?
Okay, a lobster club sandwich.
Okay, that's, yes, a different answer to the one.
Actually, lobster and bacon is really good together. And that addition of crispy lettuce and mayonnaise.
Yes.
You know.
I've never had that, but I need to. That sounds amazing. So you've collaborated with Damien Hirst both at Tramshed and with Pharmacy 2. How did you get into the world of art? Has it always been something that interested you?
Yeah, I lived in this area, Shoreditch, for many years, about 20 years. And sort of got to know a lot of the artists, the young, up-and-coming artists. And, yeah, really...
Just sort of went socially.
To, yeah, socially, yeah. And I had a restaurant next door called The Rivington.
Yep.
And I sort of hosted a lot of new gallery openings for sort of artists. And that's sort of how I got to know them all, really. It was a sort of interesting time because a lot of the new emerging galleries were in Shoreditch. A lot of the artists who were up and coming lived east. It was affordable. They sort of lived and worked east. So, yeah, that's sort of how I got to know them, really.
But it also seems like it's such a common sense collaboration because they can kind of use your walls as a bit of a gallery.
Yeah, exactly. So I always feel that, you know, an artist who has work in a restaurant, potentially more people are going to see that work going through the restaurant than sometimes a gallery.
Mm. So, in a more sort of natural way.
Yeah, exactly. So when I opened the tram shed where we're sitting now, the room in the basement, it didn't have a license. So I used to use it for occasional events and then suddenly thought I should make it into a gallery.
Yes.
For emerging, you know, focusing on emerging artists.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And obviously, Tram Shed has the huge...
Yeah, the Damien Hirst cow and chicken.
What was the reaction to that?
No, I went to a site meeting one day and my architect had moved what is now the mezzanine to the centre of the room. And we used to sort of look at this model every week. And I said, no, it doesn't really look well. I think we should leave it at the back. But I think what we could do is put some sort of sculpture in the middle of the room. So at that meeting, I texted Damien and said, look, you know, have a quick look at my new chicken and steak restaurant. So he had a quick look. A couple of days later, sent me an image of what this tank with the cow and the chicken could look like. And we sort of went to work on it.
That's so cool.
My business partner at the time said that if you put a cow in formaldehyde in the restaurant, I won't come to the restaurant.
Oh, my goodness.
Because he was Hindu.
Oh.
Anyway, we won him over. But everyone around the table...
Has he been to the restaurant?
Yes. Yeah. he even started eating beef.
Oh, he did?
Yeah. So everyone loved it. And then the next thing was going to work on finding the cow.
Yeah.
Go in there. Because what we didn't want is for the cow to be killed for the art piece.
No.
So the cow was on the way to the knacker's yard, but we had to find a sort of good-looking cow. I gave my meat supplier in Ireland the task of finding the cow.
That must have been one of the craziest requests.
I think the farmer to this day doesn't know where his cow ended up.
And is it true that you taught Tracy Emin to cook?
She always says that, but it's not really true.
Really?
No, we do cook together sometimes. We have a bit of fun.
Yeah. Is she a good cook?
Yeah, she's not bad. You know, she likes just simple things, really.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to the fifth desert island dish of the day. What's the dish that you eat the most often?
The dish I eat the most often is, I don't know if it's a particular dish, but I quite like finding a sort of, you know, scruffy Chinese restaurant that's new. There's a lot of sort of Szechuan restaurants opening up in London. And just opposite me in Bermondsey is, I've only lived there for a year, but it's a really good Szechuan called Crystal China. And it's full of... Chinese, and because I suddenly found out there's like Chinese universities around there.
Oh, right.
And they do a lot of offal, and I think Chinese do offal really well. So they've got about half a dozen dishes on there, from pig's kidneys to tripe to intestines and all that sort of stuff, which, you know, served in a sort of Szechuan way.
Yeah.
So I go there once a week and normally end up having the same dish and trying some new dishes.
Nice. Is that sort of somewhere that you end up quite late at night?
It doesn't open that late, sadly. Okay. But I do quite often go to a Chinese in Chinatown. So normally after the Groucho Club.
Yeah. Is there one in particular?
Sort of 2:30 in the morning. It's called Hung.
Okay.
H-U-N-G. Yeah. And they do very good beef tendons.
Mm. So you're quite into the offal?
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, it's one of those sort of things that a lot of people turn their noses up at. But I've never really tried it.
Yeah. It's more just the sound of it.
Yeah, like loads of people eat calf's liver, but actually, you know, calf's liver is as offally as you can get, really.
That's true. So when you go to these Chinese restaurants with other people, are you sort of in charge of the ordering?
Even my young daughter, who loves Chinese food, she's 5 years old, I get her eating all sorts of stuff.
Oh, really? That's so good.
She's eaten squirrel.
Oh my goodness.
At the Oyster and Chop House.
You have that on the menu? I didn't know that.
Occasionally we have squirrel on. And we went there when she had two helpings of braised squirrel.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
And told all her schoolmates about it on the Monday.
Boasting in the schoolyard.
And obviously none of them believed her that she'd had squirrel. But
they probably imagined you like hunting down a squirrel and cooking it on a barbecue.
But she loves things like lobster, langoustines. She's got very good taste buds.
Yeah, she does. That's awesome.
Quite often when she comes to one of my restaurants, they put a children's menu in front of her, and she pushes it to one side says, I want lobster and chips.
Oh my goodness, a girl after my own heart. That's amazing. So other than the Chinese restaurants, where are your favourite restaurants to go?
Indian-wise, I love going to places like Gymkhana.
Yes.
Hopper. I've yet to find an Indian restaurant near Bermondsey that's any good.
Okay.
But I did cook a very good goat curry last night.
Ooh, sounds good.
My friend was always banging on about a sort of Caribbean goat curry. So I went to the shop that I knew sold goat, and I made a sort of my normal curry base, but added a bit more cinnamon and cloves and things to it.
What, with goat, do you have to cook it for quite a long time?
Yeah, it took quite a while to cook, about 3 hours.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
yeah, you don't want tough goats.
No.
No.
But yeah, certainly Gymkhana. I'm going to, on the 22nd next week, I'm going to a new Indian with my friend Angela Hartnett.
Oh.
So she's... Well, she was around for dinner on Saturday, so I cooked up a little series of dishes. But so she's taken me to an Indian restaurant in, I think it's in Peckham or somewhere.
Cool.
And I think they used to work for Gymkhana, I think.
Okay. God, do the chefs there know that you two are turning up?
Yeah.
Are there any, or is there any restaurant in the world where you've been to or you want to go and you think, oh, I wish that was mine?
That's a very good question. Yeah, there are. I mean, there's a very good restaurant in, every year we go to France to Tracy Emin's birthday party.
Yeah.
And without fail, we go to this restaurant on this nudist beach.
Oh.
Right, so we go, but you can only really get there by boat, otherwise it's a very long journey, and it's called Shea Joe. And we have to sort of anchor up and swim in, or a little boat comes and collects us.
Yeah.
And it's right on the water. They just do one very simple fish dish cooked in a wood-fired oven with simple sliced potatoes. Occasionally they have, like, you know, lobster and that sort of stuff, but the menu's limited. It's crudités to start with and a couple of other things. But I love that idea of, you know, a very simple fish restaurant, you know, on the coast, where you're sort of, you know, you're eating whilst you can hear the sort of sea lapping up against the rocks.
That sounds amazing.
Not necessarily the nudist.
No, I was going to say, are clothes involved or?
Well, unfortunately, it's sort of an elderly nudist beach.
It's always the way, isn't it?
They don't get the, sort of the younger generation turning up there. They have to sort of swim through the nudists and then walk up the beach to the rest. That's quite a bizarre.
That's quite an image. Okay, let's talk about your go-to dinner party dish. It's the sixth desert island dish of the day.
Well, I reckon, not just for me, but for anyone doing a dinner party at home, I think often people try a bit too hard to impress their friends at dinner parties.
Yep.
So the biggest mistake is, for me, is, you know, trawling through cookbooks, making your shopping list, and then finding halfway through your shop that you can't get half the ingredients.
Yeah.
So I always recommend people to go shopping first, you know, find the main course. Just don't worry about recipes and things. Just make it really simple. But years ago at the Caprice, we did this dish called Scandinavian ice berries with hot white chocolate sauce.
Oh, yum.
It's really simple. It's just frozen small berries, no big berries like blackberries. So wild strawberries, raspberries, red currants and blueberries. And you just serve them frozen on the plate. Hot white chocolate sauce, so 50% white chocolate, 50% double cream, but it's got to be piping hot so that it half melts the berries. So you can put the frozen berries in front of your guest and just go around the table and pour the sauce over.
That sounds amazing.
So that's like a, you know, three ingredient sort of no-brainer dinner party dish.
And kind of fun because when you put them down in front of people, people are sort of like, oh, okay, Mark.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks
yeah.
for putting
it. And people love it. So I've reintroduced it recently onto the menu.
Such a good dish.
And there was a very famous chef whose name I won't mention years ago, decided to put the dish in one of his cookbooks.
Okay.
And left out an ingredient.
Oh no.
One of the three. And that ingredient was the double cream.
Oh no.
So you can imagine what happens to the melted chocolate when you pour it onto frozen berries.
Yep. A mess.
But he never credited me in the recipe. So,
oh, no. Well, that's lucky because he messed it up. So I heard an interview where you said you'd only ever read two books in your life, and one was Kitchen Confidential by Anthony Bourdain. What was the other?
The other one was one of those books that you read at school.
A Pride and Prejudice.
Yeah, no. It was called oh God, what's it called? It's about smugglers in Dorset, because one of the school books was about this smuggler called Blackbeard. It might have even been called Blackbeard.
Oh, yeah, I think maybe it is. Yeah.
So that's one of those books you sort of read together at school.
Yeah.
But I took my twin, I've got twin daughters, to Morocco years ago.
Yeah.
And it was, they were quite young, about maybe five or something. And I sort of checked into this sort of seaside hotel and, yeah, they were playing in the pool. So I managed to read Kitchen Confidential, yeah, which had just come out at the time from sort of front to back, just by the pool. And that's the only time I've sort of finished.
Really? Is that really true?
Because everyone was saying to me, oh yeah, you know, have you read that book, Kitchen Confidential? And a lot of people who had read it thought that kitchens really are like that.
Yeah.
Some are.
Yeah.
Some aren't.
Yeah.
So I thought I'd better read it for myself, yes, just to make sure. So, although I do a lot of writing, I don't really do a lot of reading, to be honest. I've got behind me.
Yeah, I know. We're in the library.
2000.
I know. Unread.
Yeah, cookbooks, which, you know, I sort of tend to use for reference more than anything. But yeah. I just love the idea of having old cookbooks. Some of them are from the 1800s.
Wow. So this is your personal collection.
Mm. And I've got more at home and more in Dorset as well. So,
but yeah, as someone who writes a lot, it is unusual that you don't read a lot, because that the two sort of do go hand in hand.
Yeah, I think you do find, I sort of write a bit off the cuff, if you like. You know, people like Adrian Gill, for example.
Yeah.
You know, great. He was a great writer, but also fairly dyslexic.
Yes.
As well. So I think you do find a lot of journalists who write for a living do tend to write off the cuff and have their own style of writing.
Yeah. You definitely write as you talk, which I think is a lovely skill.
Yeah. So it's sort of fairly simple. But, you know, I think more people should write, really, because I think, you know, a lot of people have got a lot to say for themselves and sort of keep it from, you know, keep it within.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And I think, you know, it's a great way if you write weekly. You know, I wrote for The Independent for 14 years in a magazine. That's all of the...
Oh, yeah, I know. I saw
that's all the Independent magazines over there. Sadly, The Independent folded up, but I do write regularly for City AM.
Yes. You know,
and in the magazine. So it's quite nice having that sort of regular voice, if you
like. Really nice. And I've heard that you're a fairly passionate collector of Glug jugs.
Mm.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, my grandmother used to have a green one, rather like the one there.
Oh, yeah.
Which sort of sat on the...
A traditional one in the shape of a fish.
Which sort of sat on the sideboard. And I used to always look at it and think, you know, I don't like the look of that thing. It looks a bit scary. And then much later in life, I found one in a junk shop, bought it exactly the same green one. And then I started discovering that there were other colours. And when I opened the tram shed, I found a chicken one.
Perfect.
So we started serving our water out of chicken glug-glugs.
That's so cool.
But then people nicked them and they got broke and everything. But
do people really do that in restaurants?
Yeah, they nick all sorts.
They steal jugs?
Yeah.
How?
Silver tankards.
Sort of things. What?
So my personal colourful glug glug selection is at home. But I've got all different ones. I've got my friend Ollie, who is a shooting and hunting guide in Tuscany.
So how many do you think you have?
Yeah, so I've got quite a few now. So I was flying to Tuscany in the afternoon and I just popped down to Columbia Road. I walked into the shop and staring at, and the idea was we were going to shoot wild boar and fish in Tuscany. And staring at me on the shelf was these two wild boar glug glugs.
No way. Yeah.
So I bought them both, one as a gift for my friend Ollie and one to go in my glug glug collection.
And how big is this collection?
I've probably got maybe 15 or something. So it ranges from little half-size ones to different coloured fishes and chickens, the wild boar, and I've got two the Japanese sake ones, but they're not glug glug. They're kind of like little fishes.
Okay.
But the sake comes out of the mouth.
Okay. That sounds cool.
So, yeah, so I've got all sorts of different ones. And it's one of those things that you start collecting things. I started collecting decanters years ago, like wine decanters, and then I started collecting pie funnels.
Oh,
you know.
Once you start, you can't stop.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You see one that you haven't got and you have to buy it, sort of thing. So it's the same with the glug glugs.
So you have to keep moving house so that you get more space.
Yeah, yeah. Luckily, the pie birds don't take up much room, but yeah. I've not bought one for a couple of years.
Oh, well.
So I need to...
treat yourself this Christmas, Mark. And you have a pestle and mortar that belonged to Elizabeth David in your kitchen. Does that mean she's a bit of a food hero of yours?
Yeah, she is, I suppose, because I collect old cookbooks. People like Elizabeth David, Anna Del Conte, those sort of food writers who were as good as, you know, as good as the best, really, writing about food.
Yeah, they changed the face of British cooking.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, so the mortar and pestle, when her stuff was being auctioned off, my friend Val Warner bought it for me as a gift, so...
Good gift.
It sits next to the glug glugs.
Yeah.
On a shelf at home.
Pride of place. Mm-hmm. Right. We're on to the final seventh Desert Island dish of the day. And that's the
I'm not actually giving you one yet.
I mean, you've skirted around them, but I'm going to get you on this one.
There's so many things that I like, you see.
This is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island.
Before going to the desert island?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
You're allowed a starter, a main course, and a pudding, really? If that helps. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I might just choose one thing then. Well, if I was going off to a desert island, I would probably choose something really simple like fish and chips.
Yes.
That, you know, you couldn't recreate on a desert island.
Yep.
You
know? Unless you have a deep fat fryer.
Raw fish or barbecued fish on a desert island is doable. So, I would probably have my last fish and chips. Well, it might not be the last.
No, it might not
be. It would stay in your mind.
Yep. Where's the best fish and chips you've had?
Well, in London, do you know what? A lot of restaurants are serving good fish and chips now.
Yeah, they are.
They're not the best fish and chips. It's not necessarily always from a takeaway. I mean, good fish and chips I've had over the years, a lot of them are sort of, you know, in seaside towns and things, but there was a very good one up in North London, which is called the Twins, is it? The Brothers, sorry.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
No.
It's run by two brothers and they do the best fish and chips, I think.
Okay, that's a good tip. And if you could just have one pudding, what would it be?
Well, one pudding, a creation, it's not even my creation, but I nicked it and modified it recently.
It's okay.
I went to a charity dinner and the pudding was, the chef that was cooking, a guy called Richard Turner, and I had this steamed marmalade and bourbon pudding.
Ooh.
Which is probably the best steam pudding I've ever had.
Wow. You
can't beat a good steam pudding and custard. So he kindly gave me his recipe, and it's got things like breadcrumbs in it and stuff, which is sort of slight different than your, you know, spongy steam pudding. So I sort of adapted it slightly, made it English and used Kingston Black apple aperitif. So that's probably, and it's also a fairly recent find.
But yeah.
I would say that and the frozen berries.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's your final meal, so you can just push the boat out and have a double pudding. Mm. And you're allowed to take with you one luxury item. What are you going to take with you?
One luxury item.
A glug jug?
Oh, I see. It doesn't have to be food.
Oh, no.
Oh, well, actually, yeah, a glug glug jug would be good, I think, if you're stranded on a desert island.
Yeah, that would be pretty handy.
Collect some fresh water. Keep it in the glug glug.
Perfect.
Well, it might attract a few unusual birds when it's glugging.
It might do, yes. Amazing. Thank you so much for letting us hear your desert island dishes, Mark Hicks. If you've never tried the frozen berries with hot white chocolate, you must immediately. In fact, it's a very good New Year's Eve pudding, and it's so easy. Just don't forget that the sauce is half white chocolate and half double cream. It's so good. If you haven't seen a glug glug jug before, I guarantee you will start seeing them everywhere now. A bit like the red car thing. The moment you think of a red car, you just start seeing them everywhere. As always, check out www.desertislanddishes.co to see the recipe I've created inspired by Mark's choice of desert island dishes. And there is no offal involved. I will see you next time for another episode of Desert Island Dishes. In the meantime, have an amazing week and I will see you shortly. Bye.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn. and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.